Welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Hope Really Is a Prison, and it's about a collection of new ekphrastic poems entitled Hope Is a Prison, with photographs by longtime member or longtime guest of this podcast. He's sort of the Paul Lynde of. Or Tony Randall, I guess it was Tony Randall on The Tonight Show whenever Johnny didn't have somebody you called Tony Randall. Jason Baldinger is the Tony Randall of We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts. But our guest for this episode is not Jason Baldinger. It is Rebecca. I'm panicking about your name. I'm
Try
so
it, try
sorry.
it. You got it, try it.
Shemita? Rebecca
You're close.
Shemita?
Shameda.
Shemita. Shemaida. And I'm somebody I'm sensitive to. I got one of those names.
Yes.
Rebecca Shemaida. So let's get. Also, Rebecca is author of Sentenced, of Waiting at the Dead End Diner, of several other books that are not sitting on my desk in front of me right now, and with Jason, one of the editors of Trailer Park Quarterly. So, hi and welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Is there any other notes of biography that I've forgotten? Or you said I did my homework, but I realized a no.
I think you're good. You covered the basic books and all that, and I think the work in itself will speak for itself.
Yes. So, let's just get into Hope is a Prison. So one of the things I guess people should know. Who don't know your work. So you're primarily a narrative poet, which speaks to sort of what I do as well. But yeah, and the three collections of yours that I've read, again, Waiting at the Dead End Diner, Sentenced, and Hope is a Prison, are all highly focused on a particular character, a particular situation, and almost in, I mean, I won't say read like a novel, but there is a strong progression. There's a strong unity in terms of subject matter, but also there is an evolution, I think, of character and a feeling and of experience that's really interesting. I mean, sometimes I like to write read a book of poetry like eating a box of chocolates, and I'll take one from over there, and I'll, oh, that one underneath the you can't do that with these, I don't think. I think, you have to read these in sequence, and they are stunning.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I started writing like stories, and because when I was an undergrad, my professor Tony Robinson in New Paltz wouldn't allow us to write poetry. He only let us write short stories, and yeah, so I used to have to write short stories and then I'd turn them into poems. So that kind of helped develop that narrative edge.
Interesting. So we talk about sort of the development of hope as a prison, because that is also as also a collection of photographs as well.
Yeah, it was really cool. I met with Jason. He was here for a reading a while back, and we had been looking at some of his photographs, and I was like, "Can I write a book from your photographs?" Because I was having a hard time writing at that time, and he's like, "Absolutely." So he sent me a bunch of photos, and then I started working on a storyline, and I incorporated his photos into that storyline. So it was kind of a new it was a new project for me.
Fascinating. And it's also fascinating for me, so I went to college near where the Crescent, former Crescent State Prison, Pennsylvania State Prison, and also before it was a state prison, it was a sanitarium for tuberculosis patients. And so it is this sort of very mythical place that you couldn't get to. And Jason actually invited me to go out. Because he was going to tour the place. And unfortunately, I guess the folks, there's, it's now the site of a marijuana growing operation. legal above ground marijuana operation. And also, I guess there was, I they just kind of let him go. He just said, you know, they were like, oh yeah, just come back when it gets dark, which was a great thing. But I think, oh, like some state regulatory things that, you know, there's parts of this building that are deeply unsafe and you probably shouldn't just let people wander through it. So you can't actually go there anymore.
Yeah, that I think the pictures he the photographs he took from that experience are amazing, because he had such range and freedom to explore, which made it
Yes.
really wonderful. It was really it's such a he had so many beautiful photographs that were so intriguing, and the story behind it is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there was a local PBS special that I think might be either archived on the on the PBS app or on YouTube about when the Crescent Sanitarium was. It was a town that Crescent is a town that's very easily accessible by railroad. And so it became a place, and there were these like sort of springs, and there's this sort of constant moisture in the air at night in the summer. And so it became both a place where wealthy people had summer homes, including like Andrew Carnegie had a summer home in Crescent just down the hill from the sanitarium. But it also became this place where people would go to try to heal their lungs. And then it became a prison. So, yeah.
Yeah, what a transition, huh?
Yes. Yeah. And so then, you know, what you did with these photographs, which I think is fascinating, is you know, this character Liberty. If you could talk a little bit about like the sort of the narrative arc of Hope is a Prison
Sure.
and the
So
inspiration.
thank you. Yeah, Liberty, like, and Liberty is not, so I work in alternative education. And well, I did for 20 years, and I worked with kids that were going through like traumatic events in their lives and trying to get through high school. And Liberty's kind of like parts of different students I worked with over the years. So it's not like a true story, but I kind of based her on that experience. And the story kind of goes into Liberty's experience with being raped by her stepfather, and kind of explores not only her experience, but the experience of her mother and the experience of one of her teachers. And those three characters are the narrators of the poems. And one of the things I did was just write it. And when I organize the poems, there's no indication of who it is. You just have to kind of figure it out, which can be difficult. But I did that purposefully so that you could understand that their stories kind of are similar. And I don't know, sometimes I don't know if it worked exactly how I wanted it to, but that's what I was going for. And that was new for me. I never did that before.
Yeah, I, you know, now that you say that, it does now, I mean, and also I did kind of read it kind of quickly, but it does make give me this interesting like reason to pause and reflect on that collection. And you think about then how trauma ripples through lives. And can ripple through a family history, which then is for me really fascinating. And again, thinking about, you know, these photographs that Jason took of an abandoned place and an abandoned place that was the site of suffering because of sickness and suffering because of punishment. And how then these poems unpack these really complicated emotions from these different perspectives. That's, yeah. I was, as an educator, I was particularly enamored by the teacher figure. Because I had, you know, not that I went through anything close to what Liberty went through, But I did have a few teachers as a kid who kind of knew something was up. And as an educator now, it's like you, I mean, granted, I deal with college kids who, at least my students, can be very sort of cagey and private. And, but you know, when that spidey sense goes off and you don't know quite what to do.
Yeah, it's such a challenge, I think, because you want to help. There's, and also now more than ever in education, there's boundaries you can't cross, be, for, obvious reasons, for your safety, for the safety of the student, for everyone's safety. But I feel like, it's, as a teacher, as a professor, that you're really, you gain such a relationship with your students, and especially when they're, you're older and they're younger, you want to kind of guide them and
Yeah.
help them, but it's scary to know where the boundary is. And then sometimes you relate to them because you've been through similar experiences, which
Yeah.
completely changes the relationship. So I worked very close with alternative learning kids and got to know them, and I was always working really hard to figure out, making sure that I was there for them, but also, there was that, professional boundary, and that's difficult because you want to bring the kids home and help them, I think,
Yeah.
and you can. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, and so actually you know, one of the poems that I would love for us to explore for you to read is it, well, actually, can we do Last Day of Freedom on page 35?
Yeah, absolutely.
As a moment where, yeah, was as a moment where Mrs. Pinsky, yeah, becomes that sort of angelic figure.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the last day of freedom. On the last day of school, I find a public library card with my name on it and a pink heart-shaped sticky note with the words, "Don't give up," written in perfect cursive. When the bell rings, I let everyone go out before me. When I get to the door, I wrap my arms around Mrs. Pinsky's waist. She smells sweet like candy or roses. I look up at her, and a few raindrops fall on my cheeks and run down my face. If I didn't have a bus to catch, I would hold on to her forever. So, yeah, I mean, I think that connection, I mean, what you do for kids is so important, and I definitely had moments with my own students where, they would get me crying with their stories in their life. And I found that, as a challenge, because you have to really make sure that you do what's in their best interest and care for them, and it's hard. It's absolutely hard. So I felt that teacher, and I felt, the pain of her, too.
Yeah, and I think there's also something to be said, and I think the way that the poem, you know, being called The Last Day of Freedom, and it's the last day of school, which is an interesting flip on kind of how we tend in this culture to think about the last day of freedom. Just what it means as an educator to create a classroom environment that just is a safe space, and how that for kids, if you don't know what's really happening in their lives, how school can be an oasis.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, I had students that, over the years who, they'd come to school sick because they wanted to be there. And it is a safe spot if you're a teacher who is listening and reading their cues and care, because I mean that's why we do it. I mean, we obviously don't do it for the glory or the pay necessarily.
Yeah.
There's so much more, I think, to education, a love for what you're teaching, and a love for sharing that, and also a love for people and relationships.
Yeah, it's something I honestly say, this is my 20th year in the classroom. And you can get quite cynical about things. Or I can get quite cynical about things, and it's like I need to remind myself of that you're maybe making space. I remember some of my Facebook memories last week. We had 4 or 5 years ago, we had it. It was before the pandemic, so it was at least 5 years ago. We had a student death on campus that was quite dramatic, and I remember talking to an aunt who is a counselor at a university, and I was sort of like, what do I do? And she said, well, make sure you have class. Make sure that there is at least a piece of that routine and a piece of normal. And it was set up in a way the student death happened at a spot where most of the students would have to walk past where it happened in order to get to that classroom.
Wow,
Yeah,
that's
and
intense.
yeah, and just thinking about like even just the losing yourself in the work. As being important sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Which the other poem then, I think the other thing about, and I will say this about, thinking about Hope as a Prison, Sentenced, and Waiting at the Dead End Diner. One of the things I really like about your poetry is within the narrative, there is this sometimes, and I could see this as, if you started writing poetry or out of as extension of fiction. There's always this very stark moment where a choice had to be made, or there is some sort of like image that is this like very core, very primal emotional experience. And whether that's centered around an object or a choice that someone has to make. As I was going through my crash course of reading these three books in a week, that was the thing that struck with me. And so I was wondering if you could also read then on page 15, The Hole in My Backyard.
Yeah, absolutely. The hole in my backyard. Before they got me on the bus, the younger of the two women who questioned me last promised that it would all be over soon. The older woman elbowed her gently. I held on to hope for a few days until after school on Friday. My mother was waiting in the living room when I got off the bus. I could hear my brothers in the backyard. They were probably playing baseball with a broom handle and a pair of rolled up dirty socks. You lying slut, she said. You stupid lying slut. After that, no one looked at me. There were no more sandwiches wrapped in the Sunday funnies. Since no one believed me, my father became more brazen. He didn't have to bring me to the track or to the church anymore. All he had to do was close a door behind us. People stopped asking questions when they don't know what, when they don't want the answers. Every day at school, I was given hot lunches. Sometimes Mrs. Pinsky would leave something in my desk. A plastic bag filled with cookies, a pair of winter gloves, a roll of quarters, a deck of cards, a small teddy bear, a brand new paperback copy of the Black of Black Beauty. When the gifts began to pile up, I placed everything non-perishable into a shoebox, dug a hole in my backyard, and buried my hope so no one could steal it from me.
Yeah. So my wife is also is an educator. She's now an administrator, but she was a classroom teacher for years, and we were thinking about one of her students. She's trying to help now, and that idea of, if you have a toxic parent relationship, life teaches you to ruin things before they can be ruined for you.
Yeah. It's so hard too, because when you think about it, the toxic parent was also a victim of whatever, happened in their lives. Not to at all support continual negative behaviors, but you wonder what their stories are as well.
Yeah.
And I find that intriguing. Like, why? And how can you do the things that you do to your children? And it's such an interesting question. Sometimes you wonder if the parents were given some more support, and we had a more open world where we could talk about trauma in a way that is in as in an embarrassment, but a lesson.
Yeah.
It would be so nice to be able to heal that way instead of continuing cycles.
Well, that is true. And I mean, I do think about like social change in my lifetime and our lifetimes. It's We're going through this moment where we have this almost sort of profound compassion fatigue. But we are finally, I often tell this story to my students, to illustrate how the world's changed. My wife's grandfather never really fully made it back from storming the beach at Normandy. And there's this family story of him, drunk, raging, and other relatives were coming up the walk for Thanksgiving. And the sitting chair, the nice sitting chair in the living room, comes flying through the picture window. And I asked my students, well, what do you do when that happens? And there's children in the house. And I'm like, well, what they did was draw the curtains and talk about the gravy. And call the glass man tomorrow. And that's it. And yeah, you do think about that. They say what hurt people hurt people. Which I think is, again, one of the fascinating sort of unpacking of, one of the other strong themes of this book is mom's denial.
Yeah.
Mom's rage and mom's denial.
Yeah, I think I know as a mom, because I have two daughters. One is going to graduate this year, and the other one's 9. And I think one of the lessons that I'm learning as, because they your kids teach you so much about yourself. They're like the biggest mirror you could ever have, is how it is difficult, to accept some of the things that happen in your life. And it's difficult to accept that your children are, people too, and they're going through these horrible things and they have different emotions and they're not exactly like you. And you have to figure out how to navigate with them. And I think it's easy for a parent to deny what's going on or, try to hide things because it's easier, just like you said, with your family story, it's easier to close the curtains and talk about gravy. It's, I think that as a parent, that's a definite struggle, at least for me, and it not in all honesty.
Yeah, which, I is thinking about, well, thinking about Sentenced, which is a collection of poems. I guess more, is that more based in personal experience? Like, I'm, speaking of dancing around the issue here, I'm doing it actually. Yeah, about having a brother who's incarcerated. And actually then, and that's one of the key themes of Sentenced is your own children and your own extended family, knowing and their sort of loss, their loss of innocence around that.
Yeah, it's an absolute true story. And some of my books are, I write very thematically. Some are true, some are twisted a little bit to fit a certain narrative. Sentence is completely my perspective of what occurred. But yes, my brother is incarcerated. And he killed the accidentally quote unquote the mother of his children. In the story, the reality of what happened in the story of his life is so unusual because we lived a very good life. Very caring parents. I had a very strong relationship with my brother. I still do. I still talk to him. But, unfortunately, the events occurred, and they deemed the events to be directly influenced by schizophrenia. So, and that's no, when you talk about mental illness and a crime, I want to be very careful. Someone, that I loved is not with us any longer, and many people suffered. So I'm not making an excuse for anyone or for my brother. However, I think stories are so much richer than what you read in the newspaper or think you know. And I think with working on a book that's so personal, you have to be careful that you tell the story and you do it while you want to tell it from your perspective. You also want to be careful that you don't influence the readers to believe something. And that I found really difficult because I just wanted to tell the story. It's totally my perspective. If Amy's family wrote the story, it would be completely different. If my brother's sons wrote the story, it would be different. And if my daughters wrote the story, it would be different. And my brother's story would be different. So that's a difficult way,
Yeah, to
to grow.
wade through that, I mean, for me, I was thinking like a companion text, the Stuart Onan novel, The Good Wife, which is about a woman who's unbeknownst to her husband was doing breaking and entering, and the old lady who wasn't supposed to be home was home, and all of these things happened. And I tried teaching that novel once. And my students could not understand how there could still be a bond in spite of, And also, I come to Sentence thinking about a good friend of mine who suffers, still suffers from schizophrenia, and though he had a six-figure job in tech, his healthcare was crap. And because his healthcare was crap, He ended up not hospitalized, but in a halfway house. And he went to a convenience store at the corner and saw a police officer and decided that he needed her gun. And he was going to end, probably just end his own life with her gun. And thankfully, he survived the incident. Somehow she was like 5'10", he was 6'4", but he was a white guy, so he was just subdued somewhat peacefully. But just thinking about how the trajectory of his life, if he had access to that kind of health care or good health care, which he's on disability now and he has Medicaid and does not have a problem getting his medicine, as he did when he had a really good job and, was contributing to society and all of that. So that conversation around mental health, especially in this country, is such a complicated one. And then what happens to those people who do slip through the cracks? And yeah.
Yeah, and it's getting and it's sad because I think you would think it's getting better, and it's not. And once you go to prison, there's no rehabilitation. It's almost zero. So that's also hard because the number of incarcerated individuals that are mentally ill is staggeringly high. So, if they are being released back into society, they've gone through a different trauma and now they're being released. So we're kind of creating a, bigger problem. It's hard. I mean, there's no answers, but it's so hard.
So I was wondering, so we could read The Prisoner's Pocket Watch on page 57 of Sentenced.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny because I just found this. I'm moving and I was packing stuff and I found this. So, the prisoner's pocket watch. The silver engraved pocket watch I gave you for your graduation rests like a prisoner in a cell, waiting for someone to open the latch and discover its sunken face and trembling hands. No one is sure when your brain stopped working the way a brain is supposed to, or when the heart of my offering stopped beating. The medications they give you to control your schizophrenia will never make what happened go away. And even though mom will probably not be alive when your time's done, she saves the watch for you.
There is a strong thread that does go through Sentenced about holding on. And I think the metaphor of objects and thinking about objects is a really interesting trope throughout that collection of like, what do you do with these things that are sort of forever trapped in amber?
Yeah. It's funny 'cause I'm moving. Well, I'm moving and I've been going through stuff that I collect. My mom has passed away since I wrote this book. And my life has changed greatly for many reasons, but it's funny because I'm doing what you're talking about. I'm going through these things that are, stuck in time and I'm getting rid of them. It's kind of like therapeutic. But like I said, I just found that watch and I'm not going to get rid of it, but I'm looking at it, I'm like, well, what does this serve? What does this object serve? What good is it? Is it something you keep or let go of? And I find that physical objects really do they're metaphors. I love metaphors. And I'm big on metaphors and the connection between things and your experiences are fun to write about, I think.
That's sort of the, this fascinating, that Jacques Derrida said, an inheritance or a gift is never a given, it's always a task.
That's well
Once
said.
you
I
get
love
that
that.
thing, you have to do something with it. You either have to be the steward of it, or you have to dispose of it, which is like you have to make choices. Every gift leads to choices that you must make.
Absolutely. And then you think about leaving things behind for people in your life. And I've been trying to get rid of stuff because I don't want my kids to have to go through that someday, But it's interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting. I mean, I'm a rarity amongst my friends in that I've really only moved two or well, three, maybe four times in my adult life, and I've only moved what twice in the last 23 years, and I'm hopefully going to die in this house. But I do think about like this house is full of treasures and riches, and I don't even have children, so it's like what's going to happen to this stuff? I mean, I have niece and nephews that I hopefully like. Do you know about Discogs? Do you know about Discogs for the records? And I have some bookseller friends who would take care of you in the other way. But yeah, it is complicated.
Absolutely.
It's
And
complicated.
so it's so strange too, because what's important to us, as individuals, people could care less about, you know what I mean? And it's a weird thing. Like I'm going through my mom's stuff and I'm, like looking at things like she loved this, but I hate it. So what do you do with it? Not mean.
I mean, we had to downsize. Her parents went from a house to a two-bedroom apartment, and all of the precious memories and all of the antiques and all the family heirlooms, and it was just like, we don't want any of this stuff.
Yes.
And all the children were adults by the time this happened, or all the children were in their at least their 30s when this happened and were homeowners, and it was like, no, we're good. Now we have a dining room table, thanks. We're good. We're
It's
good.
so funny. I
It
carried
is.
my dad had given me this couch. He had gotten it from someone for free, and he brings it up to my house. It was this heavy couch. It was white leather or fake leather, probably pleather. And it had a bed inside, so you had to open it up. Super heavy. I carried that through five houses and kept it in the garage and never used it. And finally got rid of it, a few years ago. But it went like it was ridiculous. And like I'm carrying this around and I never ever used it. It was heavy and just stuck in a corner in a garage every time.
Oof. Yeah, I know. Yeah, as a collector, as someone, as you can see over my shoulder, sorry, folks, this is an
Yes.
audio podcast. That's probably an eighth of the books that are in this house over my shoulder. I think when I moved, it was something like 20, 120 liquor boxes of books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm dying in this house. I'm dying in this house.
Either that or you're gonna need like a full like library wherever you go, you know?
Yeah, or something like that, or like I was like, hey, do we need a bigger house? And no,
Just for your books.
just for the books, and there's about 4,000 LPs in my dining room and 3,000 CDs in the guest room. And yeah, people come over and they marvel at everything that's here. But yeah, it is definitely a task, and it definitely is a burden that I will carry to the grave or whatever. But yeah, when thinking about someone else's stuff, my mom's in her 80s, and I think about like she got rid of a bunch of stuff the last time she moved, and she shopped that house full. And that I have a future of a QVC special clean out that I don't know. Yeah. But my stuff's cool. My stuff is cool.
That's what everyone says, though,
It is. It is. And the thing about an object that is loved and cherished, and then it's like, oh, yeah, that. Yeah. But these things have memories and they are connected to people. So I would be remiss by the not talking about we're doing good on time, but Waiting at the Dead End Diner. So is that also a based on true events or amalgamation or
Yes and yes and no. It was I waited tables for 10 years when I was in college, grad school, and then after when I started teaching. And it's the characters are, besides one, and I'm not going to say who, they're all real characters. However, I put them into one restaurant instead of like I worked with them in different restaurants. Some of the like people I worked with who read the book were like, "Oh, I know who, exactly who you're talking about." But this person wasn't in, I didn't work with that person. And I'm like, "Well, they were in another restaurant." So I used my experience and molded it for that book.
So I guess that's also one of the things I'm fascinated with, where I think about my own writing, about that sort of being narratively correct and emotionally correct.
Well,
And
we're
how do you
writers, we can
balance
do what
those
we
things
want.
out? Was that?
We're writers, we can do what we want.
We're writers, we can do what we want, and but I will teach but I also feel like sometimes, and maybe this is my own denial of death, right? As you write, and so that somebody at some point, oh yeah, that person existed once or something, or at least that there's a validity of my experience, and that like I'm sure like this happens for you as a narrative poet. Like people read these things and then they share their own experiences.
Yes, all the time.
Yeah, and you become almost sort of amateur therapist, or you find out things about people that you never would know
Yes,
because you've
absolutely.
already
That's so
shared.
funny.
So there's part of me that's like, oh no, Fidelity, Recording Angel, and then I teach Richard Hugo's The Triggering Town, where he's like, you owe reality nothing, and you have a generative subject and the poetic subject, and you have to ditch one for the other. And I love teaching that book because it is something I struggle with in so many ways in writing. And I still don't know what to do with it. And I don't know if I'm ever going to know what to do with. I think probably if I figured it out, I'd probably quit writing or find or just start writing novels,
Well,
I
don't
think.
figure it out then.
Yeah.
Because you, I love your poetry. I love your
Well,
narrative.
thank you. Thank you. And so for you, yeah, how do you negotiate that? Being emotionally correct, or this like sort of like, yes, but that's what makes it a good poem, and that's not really what happened, or again, squishing human beings together in one diner.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
think that's a great question. I've never even thought of, I mean, I have, but in different ways. I feel like I'm always honest with my emotions. Like that's always very, that I feel like if you read any of my books, my emotions are always present, and how I would react to any given situation is pretty accurate. However, I think that, you bend parts of the story to make them work for me, because it, I believe at times when I'm doing it, the story's not always about me, right? Even though I'm a narrative poet, a narrative, I love narrative, the narrative in general. I feel like I also want to give a gift to the reader, because they're not going to read it if they don't get something from it. So that's where I feel like the creative alterations come into effect. And usually, like I said, I'd say 75% of Waiting at the Dead End Diner is factual. I just mush some things in together. But 25% is not, and I, unless someone sat down with me, I probably wouldn't answer which ones aren't, because then,
That's a good one. And college students really are that shitty.
Or what?
Or really are that shitty.
I love that.
Yeah. I mean, they if there is an antagonist in this book, it is them. It is drunk college students, which I loved, which I, you know, there was a diner near campus when I was in, and they would just always be so hostile to me. And I remember reading, when I was reading this last week, I was like, I know why. I was not that person, but I mean, literally, it wasn't doing another cup of coffee. It's like, you're done. You got to get out of here. And I'm like, oh, you know, that place is a
Yeah.
subway now, unfortunately.
Oh, I know. It's so sad when diners go under because they're
Yeah,
so, so great.
we had this beautiful diner car diner at the end of our block that was a sandwich shop, and the land got sold to a developer, and people tried to save the diner car, and it was the, I guess the wood underneath all of the 1940s fixtures was so rotten that it's gone now. It's a vacant lot with a, you know, opportunities available coming soon or whatever thing. I was like, oh, but
Big
yeah,
chain thing.
big chain thing at the
Yeah,
end of my street's coming, but yeah.
I think everyone can kind of relate to eating at diners. You know, not everyone, some people don't, but it's such a beautiful experience, you know, if you go to the right diner.
It is. It's one of the few, like, for me, it's like Diners and the series Over the Garden Wall are on my short list of purely uniquely American things that don't hurt. Though I'm sure Canadians can relate to both of those things, so it's probably not even exclusively us, but you know, there's not a lot of America that doesn't hurt. So,
True,
yeah,
very
true.
true.
So there is a virtual book launch for Hope is a Prison, correct? I will have the link to that, but I forgot to write down the details. But I
Yeah,
will have a link when I post it. But it is what, November 15th, correct?
I believe so, but Matt, you're more, you know more about and are more organized about my life than I am. So,
Well, there will
yes.
be a, folks, when you go to the website, there will be a link to the Facebook event page where I think you register, and I think you get a Zoom link or something, and it'll be a thing.
Yes,
So
and
there is.
it's great because Jason's gonna show his work while people read and discuss the projects he's working on with them. You know, mine and others. So I'm excited.
Oh, there's others.
Yes. There's others. So
I
it
did
should
not
be
know there were
great.
others.
Yes. So actually one of the writers is Cheryl Rice, who I'm good friends with, who I didn't even know was working on a project with Jason. And
Oh,
there's a few
wow.
others. So it should be amazing because it will be his work and then all these different writers and taking it different directions. So I am
Oh,
so
dang.
excited.
That is exciting. And if folks want any of these books, what's the best way for them to get a hold of them?
I mean, anyone can Facebook me if
Okay.
they're, you know, that's an easy way. But also, I have a website. It's, you know, I'm old school. Old, www.rebecca, RebeccaCCA dash SCHUMEJDA.com, and you can order from there. I think Hope is a Prison isn't up yet because I'm behind, but if you know, you can send me an email from that website as well.
Cool. And you know what, though? It's not old-fashioned. It's good business because you own your name in cyberspace, and cyber squatters can't get. This is why I own my domain.com, my name.com. Not that there was any competition for it. But I figured at one point something I write is going to get out there, and right-wing cyber squatters are going to want to take over. So having your name, the website, is brilliant. Is, I mean, you're stuck paying for it forever now, but no, you gotta do it. You gotta own your name.com.
Yes. I had my first one stolen, so I had to do the dash because
Yes, that's,
someone bought it
yeah.
and tried to resell it back to me for some crazy amount of money that I didn't have.
Same. Yeah, that happened to a buddy of mine. So I was like, always, I keep on top of that. And of course, also Trailer Park Quarterly,
Yes, we
which I'll
are
link to.
Got Jason and I have to talk about the new issue and figure out exactly what we're doing, but and I'm moving and doing crazy stuff, so we might have to delay submissions, but our hope is to have them open sometime in November or December, and then get, you know, it takes a while for us with life, and our webmaster does everything for us for free. And so, you know, get it out by, I think, hopefully spring, but that's not definite. We'll put it up on the website and announce it on Facebook.
Yes, and what we're up to, what it's what volume 15 is the
Oh,
most
it's
recent
something like
issue.
that. Yeah. I
That
honestly
episode, that issue
forget.
was really good. That issue was really good. I'll be linking to that, but cool. So now it's time for the bottom five then. Now that we've gotten commerce out of the way, it's time for the bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic, but could be, that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I hope so.
All right. Question one, it's the first question anybody gets every time, the first time they're on this podcast, which is, if reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
Oh, definitely a fungus. Is that work?
Yeah, it works, yeah.
Yeah.
Fungus is good. No, fungus, we have a
That's
great
hard to
book.
get rid of.
It's hard to get rid of. There's actually a wonderful bookstore in my neighborhood called Fungus Books. So I should have those books on at some point. All right. Question two. And this is the Christopher Hitchens question. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you most like to write?
Oh, I honestly, I Charlie Manson's.
He's dead. He beat you to it.
I know. So I have to pick someone who's living now?
You have to pick someone who's
Oh,
living now.
someone who's
This
living
is,
now?
yeah, which is, I
Oh,
think it's,
okay. Honestly, I'd love to write Donald Trump's.
that's a popular choice. So here's the question, because when Hitchens said this, he said this in Mortality about how he was really hoping it's like when he realized that he was going to pass away, he said, I was really ho looking forward to someday reading Henry Kissinger's obituary in the paper, or maybe Cardinal Ratzinger. And then he said, "No, I wanted to write that. Wait a minute." And like, so you think, so is it a hit piece, or is this like the Faust thing? Does Trump have narrative agency in your, was he possibly could have been good once and then something happened, or
That's what I would show. I think I would want to go through that emotional side of Trump and write it so that people could see him as a loving, wonderful person deep down inside.
Deep down, and something happened. It
Really,
was like
really
Cujo, like you know what I mean? It's the Cujo story. Like at some point, he stuck his head in the bee's nest, and then All right, question three, which isn't a question, it's really a prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood.
happy but somewhat unremarkable.
Yeah, so it can't be you went to Disney World. It has to be one of those, it rained and we made cookies that day story.
I would say that the most memorable is it's not, probably not like good memorable, I guess, but good in a way. I was fishing in Greenport, and I had an old bamboo fishing pole. And it got caught in my foot, and I ran up the block with the bamboo fishing rod caught into my foot. And I was barefoot because it was Long Island as a kid. And I ended up running around a fence to go into my yard, and the bamboo pole got stuck in the fence, and it ripped the hook out of my foot.
Oh.
And it's not memorable because it's beautiful or anything like that, but it's like a memory that I love. And I tell that story and I love it. And I
Oh,
cried
wow.
really hard, and I was a complete baby. But I ran because I had gotten it stuck and it hurt so bad I didn't want to deal with the pain, so I ran. And I
I
made it
feel
work.
that now. I get that.
Yeah.
That's a good child response. Or a sensible child response. Maybe not a sensible adult response, but as a child, you
Exactly.
absolutely want to do that. All right, question four. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
Day.
Day? Day's gone.
Yes. I like darkness.
Same. Sunrise does nothing for me. All right, we're almost out of the woods here. Question five. And this one's the least one with limited choices. What's your least favorite month?
September. I hate September.
September is the zombie summer month, isn't it? Like it's the, yeah.
And you go, for me, I go back to work and it's
Same.
so busy and it's all silly stuff, you know? And not in a mean way. I shouldn't say that, but it's so busy that you can't breathe and it's still hot and then it's cold and then it's hot and
Yeah.
I don't like September.
September is not good. I get
I
it.
need to know
I'm an August guy. Yeah.
what's your least favorite? I need to know.
I think for me it has to be August because that's when
Okay.
I go back to work and it's even more like I don't know. So you're in Albany, right? Or near Albany.
Yeah, I'm right outside of Albany. Yes.
Okay. By the way, the best vanilla ice cream, soft serve ice cream I've ever had. Carver Cream in Albany. My wife briefly worked for the Albany Charter School Network, and she lived up there during the week and would commute on weekends, or I would come up there.
Oh, wow.
Carver Cream in Albany, best soft serve vanilla I've ever had.
I'll have to
But
check
I
out. I
don't.
don't know it.
Yeah, it just it's just a pillow. It's just a pillow of vanilla. August in Pittsburgh is just dreadful. The weather here is never good, except now we're having this insane, crazy drought season that is kind of terrifying. And at some point, Pennsylvania will have wildfires like they're having in Canada. I'm convinced we're moving in that direction, which is bums me out. But the weather in Pittsburgh is never good. August is the absolute worst. And I go back to work. The one nice thing is there's a punk festival I go to in August, usually the weekend before I go back to work, but that's the one nice thing. But other than that, August can just go away. For the same reasons you don't like September, August is not vibing it.
I hear that.
Yes. All right. I think that's about it. Again, I will have links to Rebecca's website. I will have re links to the virtual launch reading. I will have links to Trailer Park Quarterly on our website. Thank you so much for coming and having this conversation.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And then let's do this again. Next book, let's do this again. Our next episode will eventually happen and it'll be about something, probably another book of poems. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other services. We are on YouTube Podcasts now, too, because Google Podcasts went away. We're all gonna die, still clinging to Facebook. Everybody hates Facebook, so do I. But thank you, Rebecca, so much.
Thank
Shemaida.
you.
Rebecca Shemaida.
Yes, you got
Yes, thank you, Rebecca Shmata. And thank you to Andrew Fox for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.
it. 2, 3, 4.